The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. Hi, everyone. Thanks for coming today. My name is Andy. I'm the director of the author event series here. Just a reminder to turn off your cell phones before we start, and we will jump right in. Ted Norhaus and Michael Schellenberger are managing directors of American Environics, a social values research and strategy firm, and founders of an institute bearing the same name as their new book. In a nutshell, Breakthrough, From the Death of Environmentalism to the Politics of Possibility, views economic growth as the solution, not the cause of the current ecological crisis. Their vision of our future presents a paradigm shift in the way we can think about climate change, focus more on aspiration than complaint, on possibility rather than limits. If my description sounds a bit nebulous, allow them to explain. Please welcome Ted Norhaus and Michael Schellenberger.
Well, thanks for so much for having us here in Philadelphia. It's really a pleasure to be here. I'm Ted Norhaus. This is Michael Schellenberger. I'm going to introduce myself and talk a little bit about how we got here, and then Michael's going to talk about some of the key ideas in the book, and then I'll come back and wrap things up, and hopefully we'll do that all pretty quickly so we have time for questions and discussion. So my background, I started working for the environmental movement back in the early 80s, knocking on doors in suburban Virginia, trying to convince suburban Virginians that the most important thing that they needed to do in politics was establish a bottle bill in Virginia. And I spent a bunch of years doing that. I worked for almost every major environmental organization over the last 20 years. And back in 2002 and 2003, Michael and I, along with a number of other folks, this was right after 9/11, we were both looking at the climate science and the sort of increasingly dire forecasts around global warming, which, of course, sort of no one could get a word in edgewise about in the wake of 9/11 particularly. And we decided, you know, we really need to do something to sort of reimagine both how we think about what the problem is and what we think the solution to that problem is. So we came up with something called the Apollo Energy Project, and the idea behind Apollo was to sort of get the things that we need to do to address climate change sort of out of the environmental ghetto and orient them around what pollsters call higher salience concerns, things like energy independence, getting off of oil, creating new jobs in the new clean energy economy, the kinds of things that when we talk to people about what really matters in politics, they tend to get to a long time before they start talking about anything having to do with the environment. And it's kind of neat to be back here in Pennsylvania because actually we started that process in Erie, Pennsylvania, back in 2003. We went there to do a focus group, and it was literally 3 weeks after the Iraq war began, shortly after they had pulled down the statue of Saddam Hussein in Baghdad. And we went into these focus groups in Erie, Pennsylvania, and we picked Erie because Pennsylvania was going to be a battleground state in the 2004 elections, and because Erie was the kind of place we thought that if we could sort of start talking about energy independence and about creating jobs in the clean energy economy, that we might be able to sort of reach out and speak to a whole set of folks about the need for clean energy that we had not been able to reach through the conventional environmental messages and the ways in which environmentalists defined the problem and the solution. And we went to Erie, Pennsylvania, and started I was moderating these focus groups, and we asked folks, you know, how are things going around here? And literally, had I not stopped them, they would have spent the entire 2 hours talking about all the factories that had closed. This is, you know, a town that has really struggled in the post-industrial economy and lost a lot of jobs to the global economy. And then we started talking about Apollo and the idea of sort of investing in these new industries of the future in places like Erie. And it was just amazing the way that people lit up, how excited they got. In fact, as I left the room briefly to sort of consult with my colleagues who were back behind the one-way mirror watching this group, we were talking, but they started talking amongst themselves, and what they started doing was actually they started speculating about who might be doing these focus groups. Maybe it was a big company that wanted to come to Erie and open a solar manufacturing factory or a windmill factory. And we wrapped up that focus group, and we went on to create the Apollo Alliance and the Apollo Project. And of course, what we found was that environmentalists weren't very interested in talking about this and really didn't see this idea as particularly important. And it's sad because still today, 4 years later, for the most part, the national environmental movement offers those folks in Erie, Pennsylvania, nothing more than carbon caps and more expensive energy prices rather than a vision for a prosperous future that might include them. And on that note, I'm going to hand things over to Michael, who's going to talk more about some of the key ideas in the book.
Thanks, everybody, for showing up. I've been working on global warming for about 10 years now, and I had an opportunity to hear a very good NASA scientist present some of the science of global warming a few years back, and it was in New York, and I still remember the map of the world that he put up on screen and describing the droughts that would result from global warming, the water shortages, possibly the food shortages, the resource wars. It was literally one of the most terrifying presentations I had ever seen. And I flew home that night and got in late, about 2 a.m., and essentially went to bed and woke up my wife, and I proceeded to describe in a fair amount of gory detail this presentation I had just seen. And she finally just interrupted me, and she just said, "You know, you've really just got to knock it off because you're scaring the hell out of me." And the next day, she started suggesting that maybe we should try to get some land in the country, you know, where there may be some water on the land, you know, where we could live, you know, and survive if, you know, the things really come down to that. And I was like, well, that, I don't know what impact that will have because the military dictatorship will just take over the water, you know. And then we sort of realized that, you know, that this kind of a discourse takes us to a very dark place. And it doesn't actually take us to a place of more generosity, of possibility, of thinking about the future. It takes us to thinking about how to survive. And one of the most quoted lines from our essay, The Death of Environmentalism, which we wrote in 2004 before the elections, was that Martin Luther King didn't give the I Have a Nightmare speech. He gave the I Have a Dream speech. And when we started working on the book, we took a closer look at that speech. He actually gave it at the March on Washington in 1963. And just before the march, President Kennedy asked King to call the whole thing off. He said, "Boy, that's really going to make it harder for us, not easier for us in Congress." And King was pretty irritated by this, even more so at when Kennedy flew to Berlin to talk about the need for freedom for people living behind the Iron Curtain. And so King was in a very dark mood, and he was traveling with the gospel singer Mahalia Jackson, and he asked her to sing the song, "I've Been Buked and I've Been Scorned," which is a very dark and angry song. And her manager actually said, "You know, we're going to need something a little bit more uplifting than that, you know." But she sang it anyway. King gave his speech, and, you know, as it turns out, he did give an I Have a Nightmare speech, and he talked about the debt that white America owes black America, and he essentially threatened that there would be real chaos if something wasn't done about civil rights. And just as he was getting at the darkest moment and the crowd is, like, hot and it's just, you know, they're packed into the Washington Mall, Mahalia Jackson is, like, 20 feet behind him on the dais, who had been traveling with King and had heard him practice the dream speech. She just yells out, you know, "Tell him about the dream, Martin," from the back. And he kind of flustered, you know, gets a little flustered and kind of stops. And then she just yells it again, "Tell him about the dream." And at that, King, more to himself than anybody else, said, "But we should not wallow in the valley of despair." And from that moment on, he proceeds to give the dream speech. And it's really one of the greatest American speeches ever given. We wrote it to sort of say, well, our point is not that you shouldn't face the darkness, but rather that we can't leave people there. And it's very interesting to us. We'll sometimes say this to environmentalists, and they'll say, but fear works so well for the right wing. You know, and we'll say, that's right, it works really well for the right wing. And that's why Cheney went around right before the 2004 elections talking about how America could be attacked by terrorists at any time. So conservatives need to keep people in that place of fear. We need to take people somewhere else. The other line that runs through the book, the other theme, is just that the politics of limits that the environmental community pursued in the 60s and 70s to deal with things like acid rain and smog did a really good job. You know, we attached catalytic converters on cars. We attached scrubbers on smokestacks. But that those inexpensive technical fixes aren't going to get us off of coal and oil, which is really what we need to do what we need to do on global warming. And that's something fundamentally different is needed, a politics of possibility, one centered on investment and economic growth. And so we point out that the models for what we need to do on global warming come not from pollution regulation, but really from economic development. And I'll just leave you with one there's a, sort of a forgotten history that the U.S. government has made these investments in the past. In the 50s and 60s, we invested in the computer sciences. We invested in bringing the price of microchips down from $1,000 to $20. We invested in the internet. All of those were done through shared public taxpayer investment. We can do the same thing today on clean energy. We have to do it if we're going to deal with global warming. And that's the crusade that Ted and I are going to be on for the next few months. Thank you very much.
As Michael noted, the have made this argument that this is fundamentally a development challenge. It is not fundamentally a challenge of sort of constraining activities. We need to actually unleash a particular kind of human activity. And that's most apparent when you sort of look at global warming and the challenge we're faced with, not just here domestically, but at a global level, where 2 billion Chinese and Indians are just tasting the very first, getting their first taste of prosperity, of modernity. And the reality is that China and India are going to develop, whether we like it or not. So we had better imagine a solution to the climate crisis that is consistent with those nations modernizing, improving living standards, becoming much more sort of prosperous and affluent. So we'll end our discussion here just with a quick reading from really the last chapter of our book at the very end, where we sort of try to tie a set of the themes that have run through the book together. So I'll read from that, and then we'll open things up for questions and discussion. As surely as post-war prosperity gave birth to environmentalism, global warming is transforming it. Any successful effort to stabilize the climate will destroy the distinctions between environmental protection, economic development, and global equity. China, India, Brazil, and the rest of the developing world will not agree to any international approach that constrains the economic aspirations of their people, nor should they. The average Chinese consumes 15% of the energy of the average American, and it would be immoral to attempt to lock the developing world into energy penury. A successful effort to stabilize the climate will thus almost certainly result in a rough equalization of per capita carbon emissions globally. Given the close connection between energy use, emissions, and living standards, the implications of this are momentous. To equalize global carbon emissions is, in the end, to equalize global living standards. And so we arrive at a place similar to the one from where we started, the intersection of prosperity and ecological concern. But whereas post-war prosperity in the developed world created the conditions for ecological concern, ecological concern today must create the conditions for prosperity in the developing world. What were once preconditions for environmentalism must now become the explicit objectives of the new politics. For environmentalism to realize its potential to transform the energy economy, it must evolve into something new. As it does, it will also transform American political life. The new vision of prosperity will not be the vision of economic growth held by those who worship at the altar of the market. It will define wealth not in gross economic terms, but as overall well-being. Wealth will be defined as that which provides us with the freedom to become unique individuals. It will embrace our power to create new markets, and it will turn the environmental movement's conditional support for economic development on its head. Developing economies will be sustainable precisely to the extent that we invest in their development. And just as dealing with global warming will become inseparable from creating global prosperity, preparing for global warming will become inseparable from preparing for the natural disasters that disproportionately plague the vulnerable global poor. Many environmentalists recognize the need for global investment and preparation, but have not yet created an agenda that takes these challenges seriously. As they do, post-environmentalism will be born. Despite the claims of some of its adherents, environmentalism has never been above politics, and the same will be true of post-environmentalism. Indeed, it will be deeply contested. Climate change and the political response to it is already defining a new fault line. On one side of that line will be a global NIMBYism that sees the planet as too fragile to support the hopes and dreams of 7 billion humans. It will seek to establish and enforce the equivalent of an international caste system in which the poor of the developing world are consigned to energy poverty in perpetuity. This politics of limits will be anti-immigration, anti-globalization, and anti-growth. It will be zero-sum, fiscally conservative, and deficit-oriented. It will combine Malthusian environmentalism with Hobbesian conservatism. On the other side will be those who believe that there is room enough for all of us to live secure and free lives. It will be pro-growth, progressive, and internationalist. It will drive global development by creating new markets. It will see in institutions like the WTO, the World Bank, and the International Monetary Fund not a corporate conspiracy to keep people poor and destroy the environment, but an opportunity to drive a kind of development that is both sustainable and equitable. It will embrace technology without being technocratic. It will seek adaptation proactively, not fatalistically. It will establish social and economic security as preconditions for ecological action. It will be large and transformative, but not millenarian. These are some of the political choices that all of us will face in the coming years, for we will not put the world back the way it was, nor will we renounce our desire to control nature. We have risen, not fallen. In the words of one founding father of environmentalism, who long ago broke from the politics of limits, we are as gods and might as well get good at it. So that concludes our speaking prepared remarks. Michael's going to come up as well, and we'd be happy to answer questions. Okay. Great. So we got a couple of people over here, however, and one over there.
Thank you. I have a brief comment and then a question for you. I grew up in northern Michigan, beautiful countryside, and I was in college during the first Earth Day, and for 20 years I've worked for two large environmental organizations. So I come to this as an environmentalist, committed my whole life, and I was struck by the largely negative response to the death of environmentalism. I thought it resonated with me in so many ways because you talk about challenging assumptions, about being aspirational, vision and values and not policy solutions, and a need to think differently. And to me, it begged the question, more introspection from environmental groups about, okay, what are they really saying here, and how do we need to think differently about this? So my comment is that I hope that as you travel around the country and you promote this book, that while you get caught in the more technical solutions to global warming, that this message still resonates, because I think that's what it's going to take to really make the shift, is to help people understand that there's a different way to think about it. And that's where the power comes from. And it relates to my question and your experience in Erie. For the last 18 months, I've been working on what it's going to take to build a conservation movement around the country. And there's certain principles that you have to do in building a social movement. It comes right out of the 30s and what happened in the 60s, meeting people where they are, being aspirational, providing the opportunity for them to commit rather than be compliant. So I'd like to know what you think the role for sort of a civic engagement, populism, engaging people in communities to do the things that matter to them there. I think that our job as experts is not to tell people what they can do to help us, although we need to do that to some degree, but what can we do as experts to enable them to do the things they care about in their community? So what's the role you see for this sort of civic engagement in terms of transforming the way we think and act about these problems?
I'll address that, and then Michael may want to add to it as well. First of all, I just want to say thank you. I mean, it is such a relief to, just for someone who's worked in the environmental movement for decades to kind of come up and say, you know, I may not agree with everything you guys have to say, but thank you for starting this conversation, and I want to be a part of it. And that's actually, as you noted, sort of not from sort of folks who do this work for a living. It has not been the dominant response. The dominant response has been quite sort of defensive, and why are you picking on us, and we're doing the Lord's work. Why? How dare you criticize us? So first of all, it means a lot just to hear that. Secondly, that is sort of a function of what we believe is a paradigm shift, and paradigm shifts, as opposed to sort of the new agey stuff that's grown up around that word, tend to be sort of violent intellectual revolutions. They're not pretty, and there's a lot of blood on the floor before all is left and done, and there's vigorous debate, and as much as sometimes it upsets us that so many people have had such a negative reaction to our arguments, it's also sort of part of the process. And I want to just, in noting that your last part of the question, which is sort of about the need to engage people where they are, we have a whole chapter in our book that is titled Belonging, and it's really about the ways in which the great accomplishments, the great social movements of the 20th century sort of all grow out of a set of industrial era institutions, the mainline Protestant churches, immigrant social clubs, labor unions, and a whole set of institutions that are really sort of dying and in decline as we sort of shift from an industrial economy to a post-industrial economy, with all of the changes that means. And there's been lots written about the sort of death of social capital, declining social capital. And we point to the ways in which, even as sort of industrial era social capital has declined, labor unions, traditional churches, things like that, there are a whole set of new kinds of relationships and what sociologists call weak ties coming into being through the internet, through all of these new technologies. And we actually look to the new evangelical churches as examples of new ways of sort of building social capital that can then be translated into political movement building. And we don't necessarily say that liberals and environmentalists need churches, but they need institutions that serve a whole set of pre-political needs in terms of finding meaning in their lives, connecting with other people, providing service to others. And we look at the ways in which a lot of these new kind of suburban megachurches do that in ways that are very different from even the way that older evangelical churches didn't do it. And so we think there's a lot that sort of those of us who want to build the sort of social movement to address climate change and global prosperity and the whole set of new challenges that we're faced with in the 21st century, we need to go kind of build civic institutions that can support those movements. Michael, I don't know if you want to...
I'll do another question. She had her hand up first from my view.
Yes.
Do you have a microphone?
Yeah.
A comment and a question. First of all, it seems like breakthrough is, if you had titled your paper Breakthrough, you wouldn't have had the negative reaction you had, but maybe that's why you're titling your book that. Also, I'm wondering, everybody's, you know, in the field seems to think the next 10 years are really crucial as far as global warming. So let's pretend it's 2008 and you are highly placed in the administration. I don't know if this is something you would ever do, but let's just say you are. What kinds of things would you do a la Apollo project that you think would take us toward this breakthrough?
Great. Thanks for asking that. And we one of the critiques of the book, and it's funny, it's been sort of read to be the opposite of this, but one of the critiques we make of the book is that the environmental strategy on global warming is actually going too slowly. So, I mean, part of the critique of the essay was that, you know, after, you know, really since 1988, we had not achieved anything federally on global warming. And the critique of the book, the critique in the book extends that, but it also says that even if we did everything the environmental community is pushing for us to do, we'd only be able to get like 20 to 30% emissions reductions in the U.S. by 2050, much less 80% by 2050, which is what folks say we need, and 50% worldwide. So I know I'm getting a little technical. But, you know, so our argument is that we have to go faster. And the environmental strategy is really premised on making dirty energy more expensive so that clean energy becomes cost competitive. And we point out that, well, there's actually ways to bring down the price of clean energy directly, and that's through technology innovation. So I gave you the example in my talk, but, I mean, I think we both feel like it is an emergency. It is urgent. So let's just go and spend whatever it takes to bring down the price of solar so it's competitive with coal. You know, and there's estimates. It's somewhere between $50 and $200 billion. And even if it's at the high end of that estimate, that's like the cheapest $200 billion the United States has ever spent, especially when you consider the, you know, this awful war we just spent $1 trillion on. So that's sort of the one of the big things. And then there's a whole set of other regulatory measures that we embrace, but our point is sort of that people get, I mean, almost irrationally excited about solar because it's such a popular technology, but there's a whole set of other things that could be done right away that we think politically would then create the space for some of the regulatory measures that are also needed.
I also thought the book was great and the essay. I think you've really hit the central point. But one of the big issues is trying to get the public to really engage. And you talked a little bit about that in your first answer. The public's great at getting engaged with natural disasters and big storms, and we have a pretty good system for responding to that. But we don't do so well in responding to these longer-term challenges. And so how do you take your message and get it out so the public feels it strongly, and then they tell the Congress they've got to do something, and then we have a real force for action? Because I think all the ideas are great, but, you know, how do we make this happen in the public?
I'll say something briefly about it, and then, Ted, feel free to jump in. I mean, the thing that we were referring to when we talked about the death of environmentalism was the death of what gets counted as the environment. So environmentalists have sort of long insisted. I mean, even when I was working for environmental groups promoting studies about how terrible global warming would be, I would always ask them, I'd say, you know, why don't we actually just talk about the clean energy economy? Because to be in favor of creating a clean energy economy, you don't even have to really believe in global warming. You could think it's a good idea for other reasons, oil dependency, you know, economic development and competitiveness. So, I mean, the first part of it is just sort of saying this doesn't have to be about the environment or about global warming. It can be about a whole set of other things. And, you know, it's not just the polling and research that we've done. I mean, Gallup came out with a study in April finding that, and, you know, repeatedly polling finds that the agenda of driving down the price of clean energy through large public investments is far more popular than a strategy based on regulating pollution and making dirty energy more expensive. And a Gallup study just done in April found that, you know, 65% of Americans embrace spending $30 billion a year doing just that. So we have a lot of optimism about the possibilities that emerge once you get out of the sort of global warming environment ghetto. I don't know if you want to add anything.
Couple people over here.
Yeah, my point would go directly to what the gentleman just asked. Yeah, consider my comments extremely biased because I thought I was the voice out in the wilderness, and to hear you guys inventing the word environomics is just incredible to me. What brings me to all these issues and continues to drive me is all the touchy-feely, lefty, democratic stuff that has brought me to it and continues to drive me. But I believe in the American invention of using the enemy's propaganda against themselves. don't be afraid of the P word, profits, profits, profits. Yeah, economic development is fine, but I go to the gas pump. I was late because I had to stop and put, you know, that evil stuff into my gas guzzler. If I pay less at the pump, I'm making profits. If my township decides to invest in windmill or solar energy to bring Philadelphia is thinking of getting LEDs into the traffic lights. Pennsylvania is trying to poise itself as an alternative state. One of the most inspiring moments of the last 5 years or so was being a Democrat. I still have a wonderful relationship with my Republican state congressperson, who turns out to be a regional leader for environmental issues in all of the Northeast. From my township, she was instrumental in getting Pennsylvania into the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative. She says quite clearly the number one issue that she gets phone calls is from tree-hugging environmentalist Republicans who do stand out from the rest of the Republican Party for being environmentalists. What she said that inspired me so much was I was trying to, like, make this free market argument, and you're allowed to think about profits, and each person, even the Supreme Court has said that each person within the marketplace is a for-profit entity. And I was presenting all this, and she just cut me off and finished my sentence by saying, yes, I believe that alternative technology is free market capitalism at its finest.
That's great. I'd love to make a couple comments about that. I think, both to your point and to the prior point, we kind of go, well, how do we get people out of thinking about this long-term thing into thinking about something that seems more relevant to them? Well, frankly, energy costs right now are a huge opportunity. We have an opportunity to talk to Americans right now about getting off of oil, becoming energy independent, getting clean sources of energy that are going to be cheaper in the long term. And rather than using that, letting that be used against us, which right now, basically the national environmental movement is primed to go have a big argument about whether or not we should make energy prices cost more through carbon caps or carbon taxes or whatever the regulatory solution is going to be. And while we need a lot of that stuff, it makes absolutely no sense to put that right at front and center in how we're going to go talk to the American public about what we need to do, rather than putting these clean energy alternatives and the opportunity to make that transition and all of the benefits it's going to have for us right now and in the future right front and center in our sort of discourse with the American public. So thanks for that. And maybe next question?
Yeah, she had her hand up second last time. So.
Thank you so much for investing your time and energy in this message. I have two questions, and I'm going to ask the last one first because I don't want to lose the momentum. When is your next presentation so that I can invite people to it? And who is sponsoring you? That's my last question.
And I'll just answer that quickly. Unfortunately, we have to catch a train down to Washington this afternoon, and our next public presentation is Friday at Politics and Prose, a bookstore in Washington, D.C. So.
Can you write that down? We can email all our friends.
That's great. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
And by the way, just also all of the events that we're on, we're going to 16 cities. It's like the biggest book tour Houghton has done in a long time. All the cities and dates are listed on the sticker that you get with your book.
Oh, good.
Our website is just thebreakthrough.org, so it's www.thebreakthrough.org, and we would love for
Excellent.
You to get the word out. We appreciate that very
much.
We
definitely will. Thank you.
Thank you.
And do you have a sponsor beside the publisher?
You mean like a foundation? Yes, actually. We have amazingly been supported by a very steadfast foundation, the Nathan Cummings Foundation in New York. It's actually the Sarah K.
Sarah Lee.
The Sarah Lee.
We're supported by the Sarah Lee fortune.
Yeah.
Pound cakes and
so buy the pastries.
Cream pies.
Well, I hope you'll come back to Philadelphia, and we will turn out a fantastic crowd for you.
We'd love to.
Does everybody agree? Thanks. Come on, tell them. Okay, here's my question for you. And I'll just preface it by saying that I began my journey studying conflict analysis in South Africa and started on this road, not realizing I would end up with working side by side with environmental conflict analysts. But having said that, I go to the UN on a regular basis. I attend the NGO conferences, the non-governmental organization conferences. And I've been going for 3 years to their sustainable development conferences. My question for you is, can we imagine in the United States becoming more effective agents of social change by following this one example? Now, I know the UN has many foibles, but the one example I'm wondering if you would promote is that they have basically said there are two levels of power structures functioning simultaneously. One is the government representation, which takes a lot of corporate money, funding, attitudes, and opinions. And then there's the non-governmental organizations working for no profit to get change fast. The UN decided that one was extremely effective. And if the two could collaborate a little better, we would have more effective NGOs doing the work that the elected officials wish they could do faster. My question for you is, how can we also bring this kind of a connection where there's a recognition of the fast-moving nonprofits making zero-interest loan funds to transition people and agencies and organizations and industries, as opposed to this other parallel structure of elected officials we wish would change the laws? How do we build those bridges? Do you agree this is a good structure? And how would you recommend I write my next grant proposal?
I'm struck. We have a relationship with our social values research firm is called American Environics, and really the work we do is pioneered by a Canadian firm called Environics. And our Canadian partners, who really they don't understand this whole NGO philanthropic thing at all, and they always say, well, so basically the way it works, you Americans, because your government doesn't do anything, you have all these philanthropies and NGOs that do it instead. And it's just a very different system where a whole lot of this stuff sort of gets, if not privatized, it's a sort of not exactly the classic sort of public sector in the way that you would think of it in Canada or the EU, for instance. It's interesting because sometimes I kind of go, well, you sort of start looking at, like, you know, the Gates Foundation and Pew Charitable Trust here in Philadelphia and some of these other, just, you know, the Ford Foundation. You kind of go, these things are sort of almost really kind of quasi-government entities in and of themselves. I mean, if you look at, you know, Bill Gates is literally going through his foundation going to try to go cure malaria with sort of really, you know, his NGO in the lead and sort of governments and the UN kind of following. I don't know that I have particularly good answers to that, except insofar as, you know, sort of clearly even what we mean when we talk about the public sector is changing, and particularly in the U.S. because we've so sort of shackled government and, we've allowed for the amassing of these enormous fortunes that, you know, at the end of the day, you know, you almost have to give it away to do something good because you couldn't possibly spend it. So I don't know if that's a satisfying answer, except insofar as to recognize that, particularly some of these very large foundations, the sort of dynamic of sort of foundation as the sort of flea on the government's butt may be sort of, you know, flipping, and in some cases the foundations now have substantially greater resources to do things like get rid of malaria, for instance, then the government is at least prepared to invest in it. So,
thank you. I'd like to ask you a question and then make a comment. It's kind of the reverse. Whatever happened to the word thermonuclear or fusion power? That's the question. And my comment is, I was an editor and reporter in Washington for over 20 years. And I watched the Atomic Energy Commission become the Nuclear Regulatory Administration. I watched the United States Department of Energy be formed and had a key agency in it. Was called the Energy Research and Development Administration. That went nowhere. Industry killed it. And what we have now, as far as the nuclear industry is concerned, is 50-year-old technology. We have boiling water reactors that has a atomic pile like that was originally developed at the University of Chicago. What happened to the Energy Research and Development Administration? Why don't we have a federal energy research and development agency?
Yeah, thanks for that. The one big point about all this is that, you know, the investment that we make right now as a public into energy R&D, and that includes deployment and procurement of new energy technologies, is now less than a single biotechnology firm spends every year on research and development. That company is Amgen. It spends over $3 billion. We've been spending under $2.5. And of that $2.5, actually, the most of it's gone into nuclear and coal and something like $300 million or so has gone into things like solar and wind. So, and, you know, $300 million is just essentially nothing. I mean, it's like the public relations budget for Exxon. That's sort of the big picture. I mean, the other thing, of course, is that among energy experts, everybody says we need a whole set of new non-polluting technologies, not just solar, not just nuclear, but just a range of things. I mean, Ted and I both come out of the environmental movement. I mean, when you walk into Ted's house, you see in his room a big no nukes poster. We are so struck by the size of the challenge we face. We have like 20% of America's energy is from nuclear, and if you were to try to take all that offline and try to get to 80% emissions reductions by 2050, it'd be almost impossible. So I think we have come to this place where we think that there probably is a role for nuclear. But I think it is also important to point out that nuclear got a huge amount of money in the Bush energy bill in 2005, including, I believe, money for fusion research, though I'm not an expert on the nuclear fusion budgets. And so that for those people who really just hate nuclear and would love to see it just all shut down, the challenge for them is that we have to invest seriously then in all sorts of other, clean energy alternatives that are not nuclear.
I'm told we have time to take one more question. So,
two more. Can we do two? No, one.
All right. We got two people right over here. So whichever you choose, I'm not gonna be the bad guy here.
What if they both ask their questions and then we could try to respond to both? Okay.
$200 billion to bring the cost of solar down to the price of coal sounds like a great bargain to me, and I don't know anyone that would stand in the way of that. But when we talk about spending that money, public money, to do it, how, in reality, how would you direct that money to make sure that it goes in the right direction, that it's funding the right projects? How would you actually see that working so we'd really get the bang for the buck?
Got it.
Okay.
Great question.
All right, this one might be a little different, but it has to do with the long-term conservation program. And to me, it always gets back to population. And do you give any thought or any credit to something like the Chinese one-child policy that reportedly may have kept as many as 400 million people off the rolls, not brought in? And to me, that's the largest consumer of energy is original population. And personally, I don't think we're going to be sustainable at over 7 billion people. I've got estimates as high as 12 or 20 billion. Any programs you've ever heard of that roll us back to about a billion total on the planet where we have a potential to be sustainable?
I guess we'll try to answer a couple of those questions. They are quite different. But to the first question, public investment is no more fraught with peril of being sort of hijacked or gutted or whatever than regulatory policy. They both require serious attention. They both need to be done right, and they both need to be sort of watchdog going forward. So we've heard this sort of, we hear this sometimes, well, but what about the ethanol subsidies or the, you know, well, look, you know, it, you could as easily say, what about X, Y, or Z regulation that got gutted or, you know, perverted or whatever. We don't use the Bush administration's efforts to regulatorily gut the Clean Air Act as arguments for not having regulations, nor should we use ethanol subsidies as arguments not to have public investment. Clearly, what we need to do is set up our public investment in ways that we do have confidence is going to be directed to the right ways and that it's insulated from sort of congressional pork barrel projects, politics. We have good examples of how we've done that in the past in a range of ways, and we need to bring those examples to bear. And, you know, we need to have and take technology policy seriously rather than just kind of going, well, there were some bad investments made once upon a time, so we're not going to do that. On the population question, I think our view is probably pretty different. We really do think that there is no reason not to. There's no reason we can't create an energy economy that can support 7 billion of us or 10 billion of us or 12 billion of us. You know, the Chinese one-child policy has had some significant impact on the Chinese population, depending on who you talk to. But the one thing that we know for sure is that birth rates decline almost in lockstep with affluence and prosperity. So to the faster that we can sort of bring that global population of 7 or 8 or 10 billion up that prosperity curve, the faster that their birth rates and populations are going to stabilize. So that's our view on it. I don't know if you want to add anything.
No, but thank you all very much.
Thank you all so much for coming. We'd love to come back.
Hi, everyone. Breakthrough is on sale in the lobby, and our authors will be upstairs to talk with you a bit more as they sign your books. So, see you up there.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.